This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this bonus episode of the Cinema Recall Podcast here at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, The Vern, and on this episode, I am very grateful to have with us a filmmaker of a movie that I saw a few weeks ago at the Twin Cities Film Festival. We have with us Henry, and I'm trying to try my best to say your last name, Beryl, am I saying that right?
Well, the best way to kind of say it in English is the first name Barry and the first name Al. You just put them together, Barry Al.
Barry Al. Mr. Henry Barry Al, thank you for joining us on the show today, sir. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you doing?
Doing good. This is Henry Barry Al's sixth feature film. He is a filmmaker behind such features as The House That Jack Built, Pig, True Love. His latest feature is Driver X, starring the really great actor Patrick Fabian. Really great to have you on the show, and I'm very excited to get into more about this movie with you. Now, for those people that have not listened to my last review about Driver X, is about a man played by Patrick Fabian, who is basically his dream job has ended, and he has to find a way to support his family, and he gets a job as an Uber-like driver. But I'm going to ask you, Henry, how did you come up with the concept of that story?
Well, I had a similar situation, I was trying to make this other film. Mark Stoleroff, the producer of Driver X, and I were trying to make this other film, which we were very close to making, a thriller horror film called Final Girl, which is now being made under a different name. But in any case, we were very close to making it. We thought we were going to make it, and then at the last second, it didn't happen. And, you know, I had kind of been counting on that to kind of take place, and when it didn't, basically the situation in the movie took place, which is, we own a house. My wife and I own a house. You know, we have a mortgage to pay. Money must continue to come in, that's just the way it goes. And so she was like, hey, we need something. And I wasn't really aware of Uber yet. And somebody had mentioned it and said it was kind of a quick fix solution. So I went online and figured it out. I applied. I was kind of shocked by the process because, the first thing that struck me was I applied for the job. I sent in my background test, and I was given the job without ever speaking to a human being. And that struck me as, or even meeting a human being or speaking or nothing. It was all, message based. And so I was struck by that process as being very different. And I started driving like anybody else would. And I found it, I found it tough at first, A, because it was just a whole new concept to me. I'd never been like a taxi driver before. And B, it was tough, it was tough to do that and to see, you don't get paid a lot of money to do it, but you do it. So it was kind of another one of those jobs that was kind of a double-edged sword. It's a really interesting job, actually, because you get to talk and meet the people that you normally wouldn't in life. Mm-hmm. And then, but at the same time, it's a low-paying job. So, it was one of those kind of double, and I got really depressed about my situation, just kind of like going, gosh, I'm not in my 20s anymore or my 30s anymore. I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
And that's when, after a few rides, though, after a few eventful nights of driving, I think a month later, I said, I've got to make a movie about this. I looked out there and I said, nobody's really made a movie about this. They've made movies about it and maybe incorporated it into a thriller or something like that, or not even yet. That's been happening lately, where those movies have been coming out. But it just, that was kind of my saving grace. I had that moment of, okay, because it struck me that I'd done this before, this idea of, when you're at a low point, instead of, getting depressed about it, which I was, you know, you actually figure out how could this turn into something interesting or good, or, and, you know, my way of doing that is making a movie about it. So it energized me and it gave me a new purpose to driving. But I got to tell you, you know, after doing it, I think for maybe as long as I can, I'll do it even if I don't have to for, you know, maybe a couple hours on a weekend night or something. Because for writers, it's a great way of listening to language and people speaking, all kinds of different people speaking. And so there's that aspect of it as a writer I love. And I think it's kind of like I spoke to another writer who does it like a couple of hours a week and or a couple hours a month. And he just likes doing it because, it keeps him in touch with language from different people, not just his friends or his circle of friends. So, but yeah, but I was facing the situation the driver was facing, essentially.
Oh, okay. I mean, yeah, you mentioned too about, you know, being in the Uber cab, listening to people and talk about dialogue, because the dialogue in this movie, it flows very naturally. And I just have to ask you, was there a lot of rehearsal before you shot stuff, or was there some improv in there as well? I mean,
it happened differently, actually. So, in some cases, with two of the rides, we workshopped it in a theater, where with the actors who were, you know, I happen to know these actors, and I brought in the initial text, and then we kind of workshopped it together. And it changed a little bit. And so two of the rides were created or kind of finally written that way. Other rides were just kind of, you know, I call them like a kind of amalgamation rides. I took a character from one ride and I united them with another character from another ride. And I created this third, you know, this fictional third ride. So there was that. But, you know, what I would do, honestly, is whenever the ride stopped, I would sit down and I'd just write down the dialogue that I just heard a lot, you know, like, and I'd be taking mental notes as people spoke once I knew I was writing the script, because people say, I love the way people speak. It's a way to capture, you know, different voices. So a lot of that was directly quotable moments from people that I was able to transcribe to a great degree.
Gotcha. Now, the scenes that you shot in the car when Patrick Fabian is driving with the passengers, how did you shoot that? Was that all done in different takes? Was it all done with just one camera in the car? The editing job of that is really amazing, and I forgot to ask you who your editor was, but I am kind of curious about those sequences in the car, how you did shoot those.
Well, you know, we only had one camera. We didn't want to do, I don't know if you ever saw a show on HBO called Taxi Cab Confessions.
Yes.
Which was a great show. And I didn't want to look like that, because that show was great. We weren't going to be able to top that kind of improvised moments that were, you know, perfect. So I wanted to create something completely different, a little more, a more polished look, a little more cinematic look. So we went single camera. So yeah, the actors had to repeat those moments, on different takes. Now, we didn't have a lot of time to shoot. So I would do maybe three separate pieces of coverage, three separate times we'd go through it. And so that's the way we shot it. It wasn't multiple camera. We did not have a process trailer, which means that the car is sitting on a trailer and the driver isn't really driving. Patrick Fabian actually had to drive all the time.
Yes, you mentioned that. Yes.
And that, you know, to me, I mean, I'm telling you, that was a feat to do, because that's not done. And especially, you know, you're driving all night long, you're shooting nights, we can't shoot day for night. So we were shooting, you know, all night long, and somehow, you know, we did it. I credit Patrick. I mean, he has the stamina of a horse, man. I don't know.
Well, in a way, too, that kind of puts him more into the character of Leonard. Now that he's actually driving the car, I think that's very commendable. Yeah. That's probably the most method acted I've seen in a while, actually. But, you know, speaking about Patrick's drive-in, how did you find the main cast members for the flick? And not just Patrick Fabian, but also, I believe, Tanya Clark, who plays his wife. Where did you find these cast members?
Okay, so some of them were through kind of a direct casting process. Like Tanya was found through, we had casting directors, and Tanya auditioned for the movie, lucky for us. And I think what happens is with some actors, they look for roles that they think might be interesting or, you know, work, you know, that you know, even if these roles are kind of low budget roles, or, you know, a script that might be interesting, and or their agents kind of like perusing these kind of low budget projects. So we were lucky to have Tanya kind of come in and audition for us. And, you know, she blew us away. I mean, she's an amazing actress, and you hope for those kinds of moments. Now, I've known Patrick for, gosh, almost 20 years now. We play beach volleyball in the summers, our families and a big group of us. Actors mainly, comedic actors mainly, who play beach volleyball at Will Rogers State Beach here in L.A. And so there, some of those other actors in the movie, like, Oscar Nunez and more, there's a few of the other actors who came in from the beach, that beach group. And that, because, again, I had written these roles. And if I knew somebody that we were close to who would fit the bill, I just, you know, I brought them in because we know a lot of talented actors. And then Iqbal Thiba, who's on Glee, for example, Patrick knew from his work and they were friends. And so he just asked him to be in the movie. And Melissa Fumero from Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Desmond Borges from You're the Worst, I worked with on my previous film, The House That Jack Built, that's on Netflix. They were just amazing. You know, I just asked them a favor and said, hey, can you, you know, these were favors, you know, come in. They basically came in. Desmond was a bigger role. He played Tom, the guy Leonard befriends in the movie. But Melissa came in for a few hours and shot that scene and as a favor to me, and it was amazing. And she's amazing. And so we had a lot of those kind of cameos where people would just come in and they'd show up and they'd leave again.
Okay. Yeah. And that was sort of the same thing, too, for, like, the passengers in the car, the people that were in the car for a short scene with Patrick Fabian, with the same casting right there for that. All right. Fair enough.
Well, there was the only other one. The only other type of casting was where basically I was working with this theater group at the time, and so we cast two of those rides, and I told you we workshopped those roles out of this theater group. So again, it was a combination of things. It was a hodgepodge.
Okay, well, very cool. So I have to ask you this, Henry. What was the most difficult moment of shooting Driverettes, and how did you overcome it?
Well, you always have these moments where something's not working, you know, a scene's not clicking, and you're always, as a director, you're always faced with these moments where, what do you tell the actor? How do you give them that one piece of direction that makes the scene click, makes the scene work? So I remember we were doing a scene. And, you know, and this is happening in the middle of the night. You're exhausted. You know, you have to somehow stay mentally alert and you have to give good direction. So I remember there was a scene, Patrick Fabian and Desmond Borges, two amazing actors. And they were doing the scene. It just wasn't working. I was looking in the monitor and I was like, you know, we were in a follow car. So they'd be driving and we'd be in a follow van and I'd be watching from the different vehicle. And it just wasn't working, and I had that moment of panic of, this has to work. I don't know what to tell them, and it just has to work. And so, finally, I kind of stumbled over there, and I said, and I told Desmond, I said, just look them in the eyes, the whole time. Don't take your eyes off of him. And somehow that worked. And it was, I was grasping at straws, to tell you the truth.
Oh, wow.
But just having him stop looking away and connect with Patrick, it made Desmond, who's already, if you ever meet Desmond Borges, who's an amazing actor on You're the Worst, he is the sweetest, you know, you can't, you meet him and you have to become his friend. It's kind of that kind of guy.
Really? You know? All
right. Yeah, he's just that kind of guy. And so as soon as Desmond, like, you know, just locked eyes with Patrick, it just happened. It was just like he became that guy that you have to be his friend. He's so sweet and good. And so, but at the moment, I panicked. I mean, I was grasping at straws. And I don't always have that little minor victory. I remember on The House that Jack Built, I had on my previous film, I had a moment where it wasn't until after the filming was done that there was a moment where an actor came up to me and said, you know, I don't know, I can't feel this, you know, tell me what, you know, give me the piece of direction that, you know, makes it click for me. And I remember after the fact that I gave kind of a bad piece of direction. I think at the time I told the actor to just do it. Just do it, you know. But it was not, and then after the fact I realized that I should, in this case, I should have told the actor, whatever you're feeling right now is great, go with it. You know, that anxiety that the actor was feeling about not being, you know, capturing the moment correctly, in hindsight, was actually the right feeling for the character in that moment, and I didn't get it. So sometimes you have these little losses where you kind of, after the fact, you're like, darn it. See, nobody will know, but that was not, I failed there. And then in this case, I was lucky enough to grasp at something that turned the actor on and made the actor and made the scene work. So
yeah, well, it sounds like with The House of Jack Built, when he told the actor just to do it, maybe that was the sort of push that they needed to do that scene right there. Just that extra little shove in the right direction for that. And sometimes you make a suggestion and it might seem insignificant to you, but for them, especially when you're shooting Driverettes, with those two actors, to have them look into each other's eyes and just like, all right, just try it this way. And, you know, you try to compromise and try to do the scene right. Mm-hmm. Do you take a lot of suggestions from your actors when you shoot scenes?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, you have to be careful. I mean, look, the one issue, and I was just listening to the Stranger Things directors talk about how little time they had for that first season of the shoot. And it was interesting for me to hear them say that because, you know, as a low budget independent filmmaker, you face that even times two, you know, how quickly you have to shoot things. So you're always kind of, you know, in that situation. And, you know, my big, what I've been trying to focus on is, you know, to slow things down even when you're rushing. And so, I do like to take suggestions from actors, but I prefer them before the shooting starts. Now, it can happen during the shoot, and good ideas can happen during the shoot. You know, the problem is that, and look, I did this with The House That Jack Built. I did this as much as possible with Driver X. There was a lot of roles, so I couldn't necessarily, there were like 50 speaking roles, so it was difficult to do it with Driver X, where I like to sit before the shoot with the actor, get their suggestions, like from their reading of the script, talk to the, you know, to have that discussion then. And I find that you change the script a little bit. Like, I always like to, especially with the lead actor, sit down, go through the script. What would they like to change? How would they like to say something differently? You know, we, you know, I try to meet the actor a little bit so that the role meets the actor too. It's not about just the actor kind of, you know, meeting the role or, you know, getting to do, you know. I think if you can have a marriage of the two, it provides a good performance in the end. Because, for example, with Patrick Fabian, you know, at the script level, we sat and we had long discussions about the script, and I tried to incorporate some details from his life into the movie. That way, he was even more invested in it. You know, it became more personal to him.
Okay. Well, sure. Well, when you were doing, like, research, I'm not sorry, research, now, when you were doing rehearsal with the actors in the script, based on those rehearsals, did anything change in the story? Certain scenes change when you rehearsed it with the actors?
Oh yeah. No, the spine or the through line of the scene wouldn't change, but
okay.
But a lot of the way things were said, I encourage actors, you know, there's no mistakes. Once we're shooting, you know, if something happens, you keep going with it. You don't stop yourself. A mistake can sometimes be a beautiful thing later on, you know. I've had that happen before. You're like on set, you're like, damn, I wish that wouldn't have happened. And then you're in the editing room, you're like, no, that was great, you know, because this happened, and, you know. So, but things would change, you know. Dialogue especially would change. And because you've cast people, when you cast people, you have the goal of casting perfectly. So, you know, if you were casting something in a role, you know, I would want to kind of incorporate your personal style a little bit into it. So I try to do that with all of the roles, if possible.
All right. Has there ever been an instance on the set of Dravarets or any other feature that you made where an actor suggested something that you didn't quite agree with, and how did you make the compromise?
Well, I remember early on in a film of mine, there was a moment where an actor who I really respected and I liked, and you know, he wanted to come into the scene in a particular way, and I remember at the time I was kind of against it. I remember one of the producers came up to me and said, "Be careful, don't let the actors kind of take over the set." Kind of, you know, a lot of producers are fearful of that sometimes. And as a director, sometimes you're trying to establish your authority while at the same time being an artist. I mean, you have to be the final say on creative stuff, because you want one person, whether doesn't matter who, but you want one person deciding things in the end, so it doesn't become like a group thing kind of thing. But I have had that happen, and I remember at the time I acquiesced to the actor because I wanted to see, you know, what I respected the actor, and I wanted to see what they were going to do with it. I don't know. I think in the end it cost us just more shooting time, and it really wasn't a significant argument to be had. I mean, that was my problem with it at the time, that it didn't seem like an important enough moment to drag out this whole conversation about. But I mean, you feel that stress even more because you're on a low budget script, you know, set, and you're shooting, you know, 10 pages a day. So you feel that a little bit more. But yeah, I've had that moment, but I generally try to side with the actor because I want to see what they're going to do now. Okay. You know, but you have to do that in a way where, like, for example, I'll give you another example. In The House of Jekyll, two of the lead, E.J. Bonilla came up to me with another actor and was like, you know, we're not happy with this script. Can she and I go off and work on it and then come back with it? And I was like, go for it. And they did. They kind of rewrote the scene themselves a little bit. They kind of came back. And the scene was better for it. So I'm definitely open to that, but you have to be careful because obviously it can get unwieldy, and then you can – I mean, the only problem you have on the back end is that you don't get to shoot something else because you did this exploratory stuff in the middle of the day.
Yeah, too, and plus you kind of worry if one actor is allowed to change something on the script and the story, then others can do it, and then it's not really your feature anymore. You've got to be able to, like – pull the reins on that stuff right there. Okay, I was kind of fascinated about how you handled that. Appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
Let's get to a little bit more fun questions here, okay? All right. Now, if you were not making movies, Henry, what would you be doing? What's like one career choice you all have been interested in?
Well, I was in college. I was studying, you know, I was a psych major, and I wanted to be a psychotherapist. I mean, I wanted to listen to people's problems, and I've been in therapy before, and I enjoy it. And I remember being with a psychoanalyst who would just sit there and not talk to me and just listen to me, and it was very unnerving. And I don't know. There's something about the talking cure that's fascinating to me. And to tell you the truth, I mean, because I kind of look like a therapist a little bit. I get that a little bit when I drive, you know, where people want to talk to me and tell me things. and, you know, mainly drunken high people, but, you know, they want to talk to me and tell me things. So, you know, I do get that a little bit, but that I would have definitely done that. And one of my mentors from kind of earlier in my life was a psychoanalyst, and I always thought he was a really cool guy.
I used to date a girl who was a psych major for like a couple of years right there. So, yeah, I was actually kind of fascinated right there, having someone there in your life right there who analyzes everything that you do. And it was nice, but then a lot of times, too, it did feel like I was at a session. And I felt like I should be paid for psych work, and it just... that's another story for another time right there. But I found that fascinating when you mentioned that you want to be a psych major. Now, was there a film or a filmmaker that inspired you? Like, before you started shooting anything, what name a movie or a director or even actor that just inspired you to go like, all right, now I want to start telling stories?
Yeah, I mean, I had that moment watching Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves in the theater.
Oh, okay.
I just had that moment, I thought, because I thought, you know, yeah, there were elements of the movie that were expensive. You know, they work on this oil rig in the middle of the ocean, you know. There's, you know, these helicopter rides. But I thought most of the power, you know, and that was powerful, and they had this, you know. But I remember that the core of the drama... You know, you're sitting there as a filmmaker and you're wondering how you're going to find money, you know, or, you know, you can't even imagine that you could make a movie. And then you realize that you watch a movie like that and you realize the core of it is really doesn't cost any money. It's two actors in a location, you know, with an unusual and strange story of this young woman who's having religious visions. And she's also very sex, you know, she's very naive, but, you know, she marries this guy who works on an oil rig, and he's very knows of the ways of the world. And they, you know, it was just such an unusual story and very well told. And I thought, I can try to do that, you know, and I just came out of there going, I'm going to make a movie.
That's amazing that you picked that movie, Breaking the Waves. Lars von Trier's definitely an eclectic filmmaker. I've been a fan of mostly all of his features, everything from Breaking the Waves to Nymphomaniac Volume 2. Yeah, I'm always interested to see what that guy comes up with, and I'm really glad he got inspired by that. But you're bringing up another good topic here about funding. Yeah. And in your opinion, what is the best way for first-time filmmakers, or even, you know, novice filmmakers, to find funding for their projects?
Well, look, we used Kickstarter for an amount that allowed us to do some post-production work on the movie, some sound. Because that's, I mean, aside from paying actors and feeding people and paying crew members, you know, on my first feature, Somebody, which was released theatrically, but Lot 47, who bought it, went under, and we're still waiting to get our rights back. But on Somebody, we made it for like $3,000. It was really... me, a camera guy, and actors who were not getting paid. We knew them from acting school. I think it, I mean, look, and then, or you could do what Greta Gerwig does with her first feature. You know, you could find real funding. You know, can make it for a few million dollars. I mean, Greta Gerwig, I don't know what, you know, obviously she's really connected. If you're not connected, and I'm not a person that's really connected in that way to funding, or, you know, I'm a middle class guy. I don't, you know, have a lot of money, you know, hanging around, or like a lot of rich family members. So I do think, you know, my inspiration is that I remember I shot my first film was really a short film called The Lonelies, which I spent like $27,000 making because I shot on Super 16 film, and it was just expensive to make, you know, and it was a big short film and it was great. And I did very well with it, but I was so broke afterwards that I made this $3,000 feature and that went to Sundance and did very well. And I think for me, it's not a matter of money. It's a matter of the idea and also kind of like what your point of view is. So at the time, I was, speaking of psychology, I was working as a mental health caseworker, kind of a social worker who has a clientele of seriously mentally ill adults. and who helps them go shopping or, you know, get pay their bills and this kind of thing. And so I said, oh, that's a cool idea for a movie. And so I made a movie about that. And I think you can make a movie about something that you do that's unusual, like Driver X. I think, like for me, a lot of time the entry into a movie is a job. Or a particular occupation that I haven't seen a lot on the screen. So I do think, so look, there's Kickstarter, there's making it for nothing, you know, which I think, you know, can be done and has been done. And then there's, you know, reaching out to, you know, for example, submitting your screenplay to a festival or some kind of screenplay contest, you know, placing or winning, and then, you know, shopping that script around and trying to get that made. But for me, I don't know. I had friends who've waited around for years, and I've done the same thing for a project to get made. And that can be very tough, too.
Sure. Or maybe, like, just join, like, local film communities in your area to find out good acting talent right there. Maybe there's, like, other good producers, but find, like, maybe film groups. Is that, like, a good idea? Maybe find other theater groups in your town and sort of actors that way and kind of, like, communicate with them, too, to find out what's the best.
Yeah, you know what I mean, look, I you know, I act, too, but I'm not, you know, that's not my main thing, but I studied acting, and so one of the things I did a lot was is that I would sit in on acting classes and watch the actors there and see if I could discover anybody. Mm-hmm. That's one way of, you know, of doing it. And, you know, and there's other people usually in acting classes who are not just actors. They're writers and there's filmmakers in there who want to. Yeah, so you're right. I mean, look, I think the main thing, especially if you're just starting out, is trying to find a core group of like three people. And two other people who are like going to make this together, and you figure out what your roles are, and then, you know, you do that and you begin to kind of incorporate people that you guys each know into that umbrella, and you make the film. But look, the idea is the idea, and you have to, I mean, that's the other big thing, is that you want to try to get an idea that seems to excite people.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, I'm kind of curious about this. How did you, with the project of Driver X, how did you present this idea about this driver to people be in a movie?
Well, I think people immediately saw that there was a little potential in it, in the sense that, you know, you tell them, oh, it's a movie about an Uber driver. Well, that's short and sweet. You know, you know, you could see that. Well, movie about an Uber driver, and, you know, kind of a verite-ish movie about an Uber driver. So people could connect to the story right away. Oh, I could see that, you know. So it wasn't like, look, we're making a zombie flick and I'm going to stab you in the head. But, you know, it was more like they could just, you know, understand the concept of getting in the back seat, doing a scene and being done, you know, that kind. So for actors, it was kind of an easy connection. And for the producer, you know, Mark Stolaroff, it was an easy connection because I called him up one night, late night, because he's kind of a night owl. And I said, you know, Mark, I said, I just had this ride, and I told him about this ride. And I said, I told him about some other rides. And I said, and he knew what my situation was, that I had to start driving or, you know, getting a job and this kind of thing. And I said, what if we make him? And immediately he responded to it. He said, let's do it. You know, because to him, he saw a movie that was fairly cheap because, A, half of it took place in a car. B, another quarter of it took place in somebody's house. And he said, Henry, we can use your house. Yes, we can use my house. So now you've got you basically got 75% of the movie's locations covered. And it makes it doable. It made the concept of how to make it happen, of how to do it, something that seemed doable to a producer.
Gotcha. So you're able to tell the producers, look, I've got this idea for a story. I can shoot it very inexpensive. We can shoot scenes in my house, and we can have the actual actor drive himself, so we're not hiring someone for that. And you found ways to cut down expenses with that feature, which is amazing because it looks amazing. I mean, I forgot to ask you, who's your cinematographer?
Cinematographer, Daniel Lin. Daniel now, Lin. who he was a recommendation from my previous cinematographer, Luca del Pupo.
Yeah, everything. Do you shoot this on red?
No, we shot this on the Sony A7S.
Okay.
So that's a $2,500 camera body. And I currently have the A7S II. And these cameras are revolutionary because of the way they shoot at night.
Yeah, I've seen that too. Everything was still brightly lit and everything. Oh, it was just really amazing stuff there. My only final question for you, and this is another kind of fun one. What is your favorite movie that has a driver and a car?
Well, it's got to be Locke with Tom Hardy. Only because...
Great movie.
Great movie. And not only because of this, but, I mean, when somebody said, look, the whole movie is him driving and nothing else. They don't, you know, there's no other visual characters. And I thought to myself, you know, you can't do it. You can't hold my attention that way. And I watched it and I was just shocked. I was just, it was very moving. It was very, Tom Hardy is, of course, an amazing actor. And also the visuals, well, you know, I was really interested in what they did with the visuals because they created all these kind of interesting reflections. And I went through the extras and I discovered that how they did that. They were, of course, on a process trailer and could add extra glass, all kinds of layers of glass on the, between the camera and the glass and, you know, the windshield of the, and they were able to create these kind of surreal reflections. And I just thought the movie was just, I mean, fantastic. I saw another movie that's not really a movie about a car that I really liked also was Nightcrawler. You know, but there's that car, you know, he has that car in it and that car plays a big role as he kind of cruises the night. And I watched that movie as well just for inspiration because, you know, it was all night shoots and I don't know, there was just, but Locke is an amazing film and Tom Hardy and the extra features, how they made that movie is very interesting.
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned those two movies because looking back at scenes from both Locke and Nightcrawler, I can see how certain shots and setups right there have definitely had an influence on Driverette because the look of it is amazing. And I always like the way that the actors in your scenes communicate with each other. I thought those were really great. It all felt like very natural. It almost felt like Patrick was just picking up real people and having these like real conversations with them. It didn't feel staged at all. It always felt like these were actually really people. And you mentioned too about Lars von Trier because he was part of like the whole digital movement, digital video movement when they first started it there with like the no lights, the Dogma approach.
The Dogma 95, yeah.
And I figured this movie, Driverette, could have been done in that sort of same way with the shaky cameras and everything like that to give it a documentary feel. Sure. It still has that documentary feel just with higher expensive cameras, so.
That's right. We used music, and you can only use practical music in the Dogma 95 rules and this kind of thing. But, you know, another great film that came out of Dogma 95 is Thomas Vinterberg's The Celebration, which was shot on a one-chip camera. I mean, it'd be interesting to watch it now because I remember at the time even it felt like the image didn't hold up, but the story was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Well, that's all the questions I have for you, Henry. I want to say thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to come and talk to us here at the Cinema Recall Podcast. Really, really appreciate it. Right now I believe Driverette is still doing the festival runs. Where can people watch this? Are they able to watch it now at home or in
theaters? Not yet. No, we just wanted to finish this little fall festival run and then right now we're starting to show it to distributors and we're hoping to, you know, what people can do is they can go to at DriveRex the movie on Twitter or on the website, and I need to memorize the website address, but they can sign up for our newsletter and this movie will be out. I mean, look, for me, this movie is an ode to Uber drivers, I mean, and Lyft drivers and rideshare people, those people who drive late at night. I don't know. I just feel like they deserve a movie too.
All right. Well, did you actually contact Uber to sponsor this?
Uber contacted us and said, we want to see this movie.
They did, okay.
Yeah, you know, like early on, actually, when we were filming. So they haven't seen it. You know, we don't really mention Uber. I think you see one maybe Uber thing or in the whole movie. I mean, we did that on purpose, you know, just because we don't know how Uber might react or anything. So we were just wanting to make it our version of things.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Yes, definitely go on to Twitter at DriverEtsMovie. You can find them on Facebook. Just type in DriverEtsMovie. Highly suggest you check out this feature. It's really, really well done. Very tense drama. And again, Henry, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
As for the Cinema Recall podcast, you can always find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, Podomatic. I think there's a few other sites that my editor knows about, and I'll find out from him later. You can follow us. We are at @cinema_recall. Find out all of our past shows and interviews by going to the site thatmomentin.com. Next week or so, we'll be back with another episode from another movie. I'm not quite sure what we're going to be talking about in detail, but it will be a great one. We just took the last break from Thanksgiving. Hope you had a good one. And we will talk to you again very shortly, all right?
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.